this is Nicole Brandon, an Hourglass Bride, and welcome to the show. I am so excited about today's guest. She is the most incredible writer. Her words truly know how to pierce veils, pierce the heart, and she was a keynote speaker and presenter at the WIN, the Women's Information Network, yesterday in Los Angeles, and the Women's Information Network is in 156 countries, making differences in families and communities and women's lives, and she brought the house down. She really did, and her background in writing is amazing. She was on TV One, on Versus. She was on HBO's Deaf Poetry, on BET, in film. She was in Things Never Said, on stage in the Fight Club, in Mrs. and Mistress. She has a book out right now, which I've just been reading, which is just astounding, called Murmurs of a Mad Woman. And even her heart and her charity work, she's working with the Manhood Camp, and she's a board member there working with boys from 11 to 17 years old. She works with community organization programs called Choose and Peace. She's amazing, but when I look at the depth of her words and I look at the way that she's able to express herself to people, nowhere is this a better avenue and venue for what she chooses to do with her life, which is to do family therapy. And she does something called family preservation, which I absolutely love. I've looked at those two words together over and over when I knew she was going to be on her show, and I love the idea of family preservation, and we're going to talk to her about how she does that. And then she also does individual therapy for children that are 5 years old and a little bit older. And so I cannot imagine a greater gift to have and to be a child and to feel lost and not have the words to say what you're thinking and feeling and not know how to express that and to get Thea to work with. She works with couples. She's a family therapist. She's a marriage and a family therapist. And so she really knows how to help you express what's in your heart, express what's going on to each other, to your children, and then be able to translate that into love. So I'm so excited to bring on today's guest. So welcome to Thea Moon. Thea, welcome.
Thank you, Nicole. I'm so excited to be here. I'm really excited. Your work is amazing, and your heart is in everything you do. So it's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
I'm telling you, you people have been asking me since the minute you got off stage who you are, how they can reach you, how they can find you. And, you were such a highlight of this entire weekend event for the Women's Information Network, and such a gift. And then when I was looking at the fact that you do individual therapy for kids that are 5 years old and a little bit older, and when you were talking about the Manhood Camp and working with these boys, and so I just know that you have so much information for our listeners on this show that, you know, I'm just so excited. So first, tell me, how did you start with expressing yourself through words? And then how did those words translate into you helping other people?
It definitely started when I was very young. I was very introverted. I was a complete bookworm, was always reading above my grade level, always looking for a different challenge. And so I think reading and writing definitely go hand in hand. Like, the more you read and take in, the more you're able to express yourself, because you have this whole palette of ideas, this whole palette of colors to use. I have a friend named Elle who says that the only two books you need to read in the world are the dictionary and the Bible, because the Bible prepares you for every character you'll ever meet in life, and the dictionary prepares you for everything you ever need to say or if you ever need to protect or defend yourself. So it's really true. The more words you know, the more you can articulate how you feel, what you're feeling, and communicate to other people. So I started actually working with people with art because I was working with Juvenile Hall and bringing writing to Juvenile Hall and doing microphone sessions with the program called Assemblies in Motion. And we would go work with kids in group homes or kids in foster care or kids who were in Juvenile Hall, and give them this mic and not censor them and tell them that anything they said was acceptable as long as they didn't judge each other for what they said. And all these stories began to come out of these kids. And it was healing. not only that, there was acceptance and there was peer-to-peer support. And I said this story and the whole world didn't crash around me. So a lot of those unchallenged ideas about if I say my story out loud, everything will, you know, will be destroyed. Well, that didn't happen. Instead, they built bridges and they built relationships and they learned that they can express themselves. But I found that there was a deeper need. And even though the work was rewarding, I kept butting my head up against the fact that, you know, some of these issues were deeper and they were within the family, that it wasn't just this kid was born in a vacuum with these issues. And so I went back to school and I got my degree in marriage family therapy. I just finished my hours. I'm preparing for licensure. And I spent the past 4 years working in family preservation and wraparound and full service partnership, which are intensive programs that try to keep children in the home instead of going to foster homes, group homes, or residential care. And so that's how I got here. And definitely the writing has influenced the therapy, and the therapy has influenced the writing. So I've gotten better at both because of having both over time.
That's fantastic. And then, you know, when I look at you work with children that are 5 years old, and then, you know, when I was talking to you yesterday about the manhood camp, and that you're working with these boys that are 11 to 17. And so how do you make it safe for kids to talk to you and for kids to talk to their parents and to talk to each other? And
well, I think to start, I start with the kid definitely because I love to tell this story about how I had a mother, very good mother, very concerned mother. You know, she brought her son in. She said he was acting out, and he was, you know, aggressive with his sibling. They were very competitive. They were driving her crazy. They weren't following rules and being defiant. And I go and meet this kid. He's about 6 years old, and he's so cute. And, you know, he's, you know, I don't see anything really super abnormal, but mom insisted there's something there. So I talk to the kid. I pull him to the side, and I pull his brother to the side, and I say, so what's going on here, you know? What's all this chaos about? Why are you guys giving mom so much trouble in the morning and so much trouble around dinner time? And they said, well, we don't want to sit in the bug chair. And I was like, what's the bug chair? And what had happened was there was one day while they were eating, a bug crawled up one of the chairs. So neither one of them wanted to sit in this chair anymore because they thought it was the bug chair. And so they would have this big tussle every morning over who has to sit in that chair because the family didn't have a lot of money and there were only three chairs. And what that story taught me is that a lot of times parents think one thing is the problem, but if you really talk to the kid, you find out it's something completely different. So the first thing I do is I talk to the kid and I isolate them from the parent. And sometimes parents have a hard time with this, but I explain to them that, you know, if they feel like I'm an extension of you, they won't tell me everything that they need to tell me. They'll feel like there's a risk of hurting your feelings or making you angry. So it's important that they have their own space. And I set those boundaries early, but I reassure the parent that I'm going to empower the child to have the language to come back and communicate whatever those issues are directly to the parent. And that's what I do. I teach the kid, okay, how are you going to say this to your mom? Let's practice how we're going to say it. But I first start by letting them know this is your space and you have all the power here. You are in control of the situation. And I think from there, they kind of develop their own treatment. You know, it's so important that they set their own goals. If I make the goal or the parent makes the goal, how hard are they really going to work? You know, if they make the goal, then they're invested. And so you really, just like anybody else, kids are just little versions of us, you know. We want to be in control. We want to feel safe. We want to set our own terms, and they feel the same way. And if you give them the space to do that, then usually they come out of it with a little bit of help.
I love that. That's amazing. And when I was looking at the words family preservation together, that's so rare to see those two words side by side.
Yeah.
And there's even just an energy when you read it, and there's an energy when you say it. And I've never actually met anybody who that's something that they strive. You know, you have people that do mediation, but but I've never seen preservation. And
yeah.
So tell me about how you came up with family preservation and how you do that and what that is to you.
Family preservation is a program that it's run through the county, and it's a program usually for families who are having significant issues but not significant enough to come into full contact with Department of Children and Family Services, meaning that the children can still remain in the home and be safe, but there are some concerns that they want to keep an eye on, or they're returning home to their parents, so they're being reunified. And so the goal of this program is to give the family the support and the tools they need to preserve the family. It's a great program. In fact, it's my favorite out of all the programs I've worked with. Unfortunately, it's underfunded and funded, and it's not the priority, unfortunately, which it should be, I think, because I think if we have more family preservation energy, like you were saying, or approach to families, then we would have less of a need for some of the more intensive services, right? But that's not the mindset. The mindset is to be reactive as opposed to proactive, unfortunately. But it's a great program, and I really enjoyed working in it because the families were at the precipice of wanting hope and change. They hadn't fallen too deep into the situation where you have to kind of dig them out. They were ready for something, and they wanted something, and they were still feeling very confident and self-assured that answer was in them. A lot of the families that are in the more intensive programs have been disempowered through the process. So they feel like they go wherever the system is going to take them. They don't feel like they have a lot of control over the outcome, and they become very dependent on systems and programs. And that's the opposite of what we should want. We should want these families to know that the answer to your family's wellness lies within your family, and we're just here to remind you about that and reflect that back to you. But that's unfortunately not the priority, which is why I enjoy being able to write and create that environment to continue the energy of preservation and of, you know, reminding people of their power, as opposed to trying to dig them out of disempowerment, which is a lot more difficult.
I love this. I mean, giving people their power. It's funny, we had Kathy Lee Crosby there yesterday honoring the Los Angeles firefighters.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, who were Wonder Women. And we were talking about today power, and that these women were so focused.
Mm-hmm.
They were so contained. And it was funny because Deirdre Haidt was saying this morning that if your house is on fire, you don't want your girlfriends there going, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Or you want these firefighter women that are, like, focused and know what to do.
Yes.
I mean, she had but when you harness that power and you have that ability and that agility and that strength and saying this is where that should go.
Yeah.
And the fact that you're able to funnel that energy and channel that energy and see that energy. And so when does somebody come to you? Do people come to you first? Like, you know, people are just getting married here, or they're integrating families, or they're gaining stepchildren, or there's so many different scenarios of our listeners. But do people come to you because before they step on a landmine, they want to make sure they're walking right that something doesn't blow up? Or do people come to you when things are in chaos and they don't know which is the thread to pull?
I wish more people had a proactive view of therapy, of like, you know, I want to be prepared. I want to know what's going on with this. I want to explore this. I wish people had that and thought of it more as a tool than as a last resort. Most people will only come when they have to. They come when they're in crises. They say that by the time most couples come in for therapy, one person's already checked out. And so that's really late. That's what I'm talking about. That's when the couple has felt hopeless and disempowered and lost that connection. And so the work to get them back to where they need to be is more difficult. Is it possible? Absolutely. But it requires so much more energy for them and the person working with them. Whereas a healthier approach would have been, hey, we're looking at blending our family that can be really challenging. Maybe we should go somewhere, talk to somebody about who's a third party, who can look at both of our backgrounds and, you know, how, what we think about parenting, ask us questions we're not even thinking about, you know, and we flush out a plan so we can really know what we're getting into. And that's not just for a blended family. That's if you're just having a child. You know, if you're having a child, I always say having children awakens your inner child and reminds you of all the things you did not get or things that you feel were significant. That may be very different from your partner, and that's usually not triggered until you have your own child to make a decision about, right? So I think, I wish it was, and I encourage people to use it as a check-in. If you've been married a year, you've been dating a year, and you kind of really think things are going really well, and you feel things, it's not a bad thing to go and talk to a third party about where is this relationship heading? Are we having the right conversations? Are there conversations we should be considering at this point? And it can be a really healthy tool, as opposed to being a last minute ditch effort to save something.
That's I love that. You know, you make the distinction. And I also enjoy so much that you're saying, gosh, I wish somebody did come in first, because that's one of the things we talk about on this show is combining money. And we've had Shelley Campbell on, from who wrote Zero to Zillionaire, and Sherry, you know, Shelley's amazing, and DC Cordova, who was one of the presenters yesterday from the Money and You Institute, talked about
amazing.
Money and You and Money and Us, isn't she? And truly, you know, they were talking about those are conversations you want to have first about money. We also had, you know, somebody come on and talk about estate planning and wills and, you know, all of that, you know, prenuptial agreements and legal contracts. But people do not talk about how are we going to handle problems or how are we going to handle the kids or how are we going to, you know. And so when those things come up, if they have a different way of handling problems or disciplining children or whatever that is, and then all of a sudden there's this storm. And then, you know, when I look at your thing and it's just couples and family therapy, so my question is that different? Because you were saying that kids should have their own therapist. So, but if you're a family therapist, are you working with the kids and the adults at the same time, or, you know, are you just doing kids or adults?
You know, it depends on the, it kind of depends on the scenario, right? Because 90% of the time, the family's going to come in with what we call an IP, which is an identified patient, right? So there's somebody, and this is just kind of like a family systems overview. This is kind of how people view families. Somebody in the family is causing all the problems. It's not all of us. This is one of us. And if this one person could get fixed, then the whole family would be so much better, right? So this is your identified patient. And so the family, even if they come in together, in their mind, they're all thinking it's not me, it's the identified patient. So I always, depending on the situation, if I feel like the family has a healthy communication going and they're just kind of in a difficult place, I can work with all of them together. If I feel like there's individual needs that aren't being met that could make a family session ineffective, then I'll talk with them individually first, so that I can create an atmosphere so that a family session can be effective. And I think that part of that prep work is to make the family aware about what a family dynamic looks like. Make the family aware that we all play different roles. Some of us may disappear when conflict happens. Some of us may speak out. That's usually your identified patient, right? They're the one that acts out all the anxiety that the family is feeling. Families transfer anxiety from person to person. They build alliances. If mom and dad are having issues in their relationship, they might yell at the kids more. And the kid has nothing to do with it, but it's their way of relieving anxiety, right? If the two siblings are having issues, they might be defiant towards mom because they're transferring their anxiety. So there's this interesting synergy between family members that they're not even conscious of. And so I really talk to them a lot about that energy transfer that happens in the family, that even if you're identified patient, the moment he stops acting out, right, somebody else in the family is going to start acting out. because the family has created an idea of normalcy around somebody being identified as the wrong one. And they all have to get comfortable with, we all are responsible. We all contribute to this space and this energy. So it really just depends on the family that comes in and how I assess their communication skills, their accountability, you know. And I use a lot of psychoeducation. I educate them up front about what family dynamics look like and what that transfer of energy can be like. And I try to take some of the pressure off that identified patient.
That's brilliant. And finger pointing, as I remember my dad used to tell me that when you point a finger at somebody, three fingers are pointing back at you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so it's just one of those things I always remembered from my childhood. So, and then how did you get started? I mean, how did you know you wanted to go into therapy? Or is that, because, I mean, we talk to little kids, like they want to be veterinarians and astronauts and movie stars, you know, but people don't usually say when they're 7 or 9, you know, I want to be a therapist. But it sounds like when you were little, you were helping people or that you were sharing your thoughts in a really profound way.
I think when I was little, I was definitely writing, but I wanted to be a pediatrician. I fell in love with my pediatrician. She was so awesome, and I wanted to be cool just like her when I was about 7 or 8. And so I went to school for that first, thinking I was going to study biological sciences, and sat in a chemistry class, and everybody was all excited, and I could care less about anything that was happening in that class. And so I said, this is not the right route. So then I wanted to follow my writing passions. And so I, you know, took up creative writing and English. And then that kind of stalled out a little bit for me, and I took a break from school. So during that break, I really just pursued art more. This is when I got my big break with deaf poetry, and I started performing around the country and things like that. And so I was like, well, I don't ever have to go back to school. I'm just going to do this forever. I love this. But what the art did was it opened up avenues for me to work with more people. And so I started being used a lot more in juvenile halls and schools. And eventually I decided, you know, I kind of like this work. So I took a job working as an investigator for attorneys who work with children. And I would interview children and talk to children. And I think at the time I felt like I would hear these heart-wrenching stories and not have the skills to do anything about it. And I wanted to go back to school and figure out how I could do something about it. And so I did. I went back to school while I had my two girls, while I was married at the time, and got my degree and pursued my hours. And I love it. I truly, truly, you know, for me, therapy and writing or performing are very similar. They're both ways to connect and establish relationship and establish love. Because that time while that person is in your presence and in your session, you know, you love them and you're there for them, and it's unconditional. And it really is this unconditional regard for who they are and desire to want them to be the best they can be. And sometimes that can be confrontational because you love them, and sometimes it can be nurturing, and sometimes it could be challenging them, but it's all love. Same thing with my writing. You know, I'm very raw a lot of times with my writing. I don't hold punches. I don't flower everything up. I try to go straight for the emotion of the situation. So I think that's what led me there. I just wanted to go deeper with people, and it's kind of parallel with my writing.
And your writing is just amazing. You know, and I am going to talk about your writing as well, because when I looked at the categories in your book, and I started reading your book, I can't wait to talk to you about it. And we even called today's show, you know, we titled today's show one of the chapters off of your book, The Landmines and Landslides. And so when you have an emotion, you know, and we're going to talk about some of the categories on your, that you're writing about being a woman, is just incredible. But how do you say, okay, this is rage, this is anger, this is love, this is sex, whatever this is, and I'm going to categorize this as this particular landmine or landslide? Like, how do you take that emotion and say, this is what it means to me?
I think with that book, what was interesting, Nicole, is that that book was pretty much written like 2 years ago. Like, I had all the pieces, but this is how strong emotion is, and this is how important alignment is. I was too in it to to objectively be able to put it in the right order. I was waiting for the right order, and I couldn't see the right order clearly because I was still too in a lot of the things that I was writing about. And so I had to put it aside and experience the emotion so that I could really, really assess what is the right order for this book. The order of the book is so important to me because I didn't want the book to just be deemed a poetry book and put on someone's back shelf. I wanted it to transcend that. I wanted it to be a collection about healing. And it has to read as one story, even though there are different pieces and facets to that story. So it was like putting together a puzzle without a picture. And a friend gave me some amazing advice when I was doing this, and she said, okay, you read your poems, and then ask yourself, what else is this poem about? So poems in the book that may have been about grief or loss were also about motherhood. Were also about, you know, healthcare. Were also about all these other things. And so they began to fit into different categories than I originally intended. And that was just a beautiful process for me and a lesson in not just looking at the surface of things, but turning it over, flipping it inside out and saying, what else is this saying? And I was able to go back through the process and do that with all of the poems. And now I'm so happy with the order. I'm so happy with how it came out because I feel like it does what I wanted it to do. And it takes a person from one end of a spectrum to another, and they get to experience a range of emotions in between that are just human. And that's important to me. I speak in emotion. I really speak in emotion because it's universal. And my work, I get feedback from different countries and different ethnicities and different genders and everything, you know, because I speak in emotion. And emotion is a universal language.
It is a universal language. And I think that when I was reading your poems, and they're so raw and they're so real. And even when you were on stage and then reading through some of these, whether you're talking about a relationship, you know, with your daughter, or you're talking about affairs, or you're talking about, you know, woman to woman or relationships with your body. And so, you know, what advice would you give to women that are just stepping into a new stage of their life?
I think... It's so much. The best advice I give is to speak your truth, and that is loving. It's loving to let somebody know who you really are. It's loving to let somebody know where you really stand. It's loving to let somebody know what you really need. Because when you don't do those things out of fear of not pleasing them or displeasing them, then you create anxiety for them because they have to guess and they're not sure and they don't know what to do and they start to flounder and it creates a lot of anxiety. And I think we're taught the opposite. We're socialized to think, don't say things, just let things happen, or, you know, don't speak up. And that actually creates a more confusing atmosphere. I think the relationship I'm in right now is a lot healthier than the one I was in before because I'm so much clearer. You know, I'm so much more like, no, this is something that I need. So I'm not giving that up. I need this. And I'm so much more comfortable with that. I'm comfortable expressing anger. If I'm angry, I say I'm angry. If I'm happy, I say I'm thrilled. And I'm just clear. And I think it's really hard because women, you know, we put together this image of what wives look like, of what mothers should be like. And nobody wants to feel like they're not meeting that standard. And so what do? We don't talk about it. We don't talk about how difficult it is to work full-time and keep a house clean and take care of kids and cook dinner, that sometimes we don't want to do that. And sometimes we're angry about that, but we can't show that because if we show that, then we're not being real women. We're not being real mothers or wives. we don't talk about, you know, that we may have sexual needs that we're not expressing because we don't want to be judged a certain way by our husbands. We don't talk about emotional neglect and what that feels like to feel unwanted by your husband. We're scared to be the first one to say it because we think all these women are going to look at us and say, oh, that's you, that's not me. And it's the opposite. When I have finally broken my silence and said, does anybody else feel like they're going crazy around here? I could hear like a collective sigh of relief in the room, you know, like, oh my God, I thought I was the only one. I remember this moment, Nicole, where I was doing home visits. I have two kids, they're 8 and 9, but at that time they had to be like, you know, 4 and 2 and a half, something like that. I was working full time, I was going to school, still trying to keep the house clean, still trying to cook dinner every night, and I walk into this older Latino woman's house, and it's immaculate, and I immediately feel judged, like, oh my God, she could keep this house so clean, how does she do it? And she's like, you know, I'm going through everything with her, answering the question, and finally, before I left the house, I said, I have to ask you, how do you keep your house so clean? How do you keep your house this clean? And she said, oh, sweetie, I don't clean this house. I have somebody that comes in here and helps me with that. And do you know how shocked I was? Like, and I realized it's very similar to, like, women in magazines. They don't really look like that. It's a facade, you know. You go into these places and you think people have these perfect images, but they're like, no, sweetie, I got somebody who helps me with that. I could never do all that. And you realize you've been trying to live up to an impossible standard. And you've done that because you've been silent about how you really feel and what you really need, you know. And I enjoy having real conversations with women. And I'll be the first one to say, listen, no, I can't do this. I need help with this. I think this is ridiculous. Because I know if I say it, that the other women in the room will feel comfortable saying it too. And so I've made the choice to be shameless with this thing so that other women can feel like they can let it out.
And then when I was reading your work, as you're saying that, I mean, how do people respond? Because your stuff is so in your face, and it's so raw, and it's so true. I mean, I can't imagine anybody reading this and not saying, oh my gosh, I felt that way. I feel that way. That's the way I think. Or in that moment, I wish I could have said that to X, Y, and
yeah.
Z. And so what is the response, and what do people say to you after they hear your words and read your writing?
I've been so blessed. I think I finally am starting to get what it means to be the kind of artist that I am, and that is, you know, to take the responsibility very seriously of editing down to the emotions and no ego. Because when you can do that, it does exactly what you're saying. You know, it gets to the people it needs to get to. I've gotten feedback from people in Afghanistan, Germany, France, from men, women, all races, all age groups. One woman wrote and said, it feels like this book is the journal I never took the time to write. A man wrote me and said, I never would have understood what it felt like to be on the receiving end of this as a woman, but it made me more conscious of my actions as a man. It's not even male-female. The book is about healing and loss and recovery. But I'm very happy that people are able to forget at a certain point while reading it that I wrote this and start to feel like, oh, my God, I could have wrote this. I'm very happy about that. To me, that means I was obedient to, you know, that inspiration that God gave me, and I was obedient to translating it. Because if they kept seeing me in it, they would never be able to see that about themselves. And the point is to edit me so much out of it that they can see themselves. And at a certain point, the lessons learned in the book are their own, and they leave with that. So I've been very happy with the response. And I'm always open, because I'm sure there's some people who don't like knowing these things or hearing these things, but that's fine. As long as it makes you feel something, I'm satisfied.
That's so beautiful. I was so moved, and I'm just not even all the way through it. I was trying, you know, I was reading it this morning while I was waiting for you to go on. I'm still at the hotel. And so, and I said to our show producer right before the top of the show, I said, I'm so tired, it hurts me to smile right now. You know, I said, I was up for 48 hours. So it's like,
oh my God.
So I'm still at the hotel, but it was just such a comfort. And it was almost like I could marinate in your book. I was like, oh, this is so wonderful.
I'm so glad. Oh, that makes me so happy.
So fantastic.
That makes me so happy.
I mean, truly. And then, you know, when we talk about families and we talk about couples, one of the things that I really, you know, want to present here is as a couple, how you pick your charities, how you pick who you're going to give to and who you're going to, whether it be your financial resources, your time, your energy, your light, your love. And so talk to me about, you know, the Choose Peace and the Manhood Camp. And as a couple, how do you find those organizations that you want to help?
Well, Mark is kind of born out of a similar experience. So he also worked with at-risk populations. And he's a very, he's a visionary, too. So he's very... let's try this. Let's do this. Let's try that. I mean, he'll come through the job and say, we're going to send this mom and his dad to a spa to reconnect. And everybody's looking like, what are you talking about? Who's going to do that? And he's like, no, it'll work. It'll totally work. And he thinks outside the box. And we've actually partnered with organizations that do that are interested in alternative ways of reaching people because there's no one way. And a lot of the population that we work with are not very open to mental health services and traditional therapy, but they are very open to experiences, like to trying things and to going to see things. And so incorporating and bringing experiences to them is important to us, and that's part of what we look for. We look for people who are doing something different. You know, we don't want to see the same thing. We want to see a new approach to an old problem. And that's a big part. I do a lot of work with women's groups, and that's kind of like my own section. And I support when Mark works a lot with boys, sometimes I'll come in there and I'll do, you know, workshops with them on relationships. And I think where we kind of meet in the middle is our community programming. So like Choose Peace was an event we put together. And we said, you know, well, everybody talks about wanting peace in their community, so what creates peace in a community? And we were like, well, access to resources. So we created this, like, resource fair, invited people out to tell people about what they do. Because a lot of people had no idea that organizations exist that can help you with X, Y, or Z. And so this was our way of introducing the community to the resources. And we had, you know, kids come out and perform and musical artists and things of that nature. But that was the goal. The goal was, okay, how do you maintain peace? And from there, we were contacted a few times to work with other programmings. We're doing an event in November. That's the second part of the event. It's kind of like a community speak out. And we're inviting you to discuss, you know, issues they may have with in the community, which it's been done before, but it's never been partnered with the police department. And so we're partnering with the police department to sort of change the stigma between teenagers and police and to get young people more involved in understanding law, understanding, you know, the responsibility of police officers, but also to give police officers a glimpse of these kids walking around in hoodies and give them another image of these kids that they're artists or dancers or, you know, A students, and not all of them are walking around, you know, being knuckleheads. So it's actually been really great. We are having our second one in November we're excited about and hoping to get some more of the kids to come out and speak up. And that's another setting where we sort of like have the adults take a back seat, because sometimes adults think they know what kids need and they don't. And that can block the kids from speaking up. So it all works together. And that's kind of like how we've found things so far. And we just support whatever we want to try. It, you know, if he brings something home different, I'm going to say, okay, well, let's give it a shot, and vice versa. So he's a very good guy.
He's amazing, absolutely amazing. And there's somebody I want to connect him with, too. I have a friend that we're bringing on the show that does the 12 Pillars of Manhood. And
Oh, wow. He
incredible program. And he talks about how in every society, how there's the kids are sent out on like a pilgrimage. And then those boys are initiated, whether it be, through a bar mitzvah, the boys get all that stuff. And then, and then they take the knowledge and then you mentor. And that there are all these stages and kids that don't have that. Those pillars.
They really don't.
And then that's, and so then they find their community in gangs, or they find their, and all, it's so interesting. And he's, going to be coming on the Unlimited Life show and talking, but I'd love to connect him with Mark, and we'll do that separately from the show.
That would be great.
Just really fabulous. And then, and choose peace, which of course is just such a beautiful idea. And the fact that you're doing this, and as far as the programs that you're doing, the Manhood Camp and Choose Peace, and as far as your counseling, which I just think is remarkable. How do people find you? People that want to work with you, do they go to your website? Do they call you? How does somebody reach out to you?
Yes, I have a website, theamonier.com. That's M-O-N-Y-E-E. My email is bookthea, C-H-E-A, at Gmail. And I usually update things. Manhood Camp also has, manhoodcamp.org has a website. Say Word LA has a website, and that's the program where we actually teach spoken word as curriculum in schools with my friend Kat McGill. So, through my website, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, I'm on all those things, and I love connecting with new people with new ideas. I connected yesterday with Dr. Sherry, and I just wanted her, I said, just use me. Don't even tell me how. Just call me and say, Tia, you're going to be used and I'll be there. Because I like to be a part of what people are doing.
She has done the most incredible work. And it's really interesting when we talk about words. I just want to share this with you. I went with Sherry Clark. We're talking about Dr. Sherry Clark to the prisons, to the shock program. And what an experience. I mean, the program itself is just amazing. These kids have to ask the judge to be in this program, and then they go in and they have fitness in the morning, and then they go to school, and everybody goes to school. You graduate high school, you get your GED, and if you've already graduated, you teach trigonometry, you teach English, everybody goes to school, and then counseling, group counseling, private counseling, and then you have career training. So if you play the oboe, they'll teach you composing. If you're an artist, they teach you graphic design, and then instead of being released, you graduate with your friends, with your family, and then they have years, of counseling, of people helping you on the outside. So, and they only have a 4% return rate, which is crazy. I was in the prison, and when you go in, it was one of the baddest prisons, without me saying the name, but I can tell you it's one of the baddest prisons in our nation, and toughest, and the guard at the door had all the, guns around his body, and he had all this stuff, and he's the one that makes you, take everything out so you're like a skeleton, invisible, and they make sure you don't have weapons or whatever. And he is the one that's supposed to frighten you into stepping foot into place. And then they mark your arm in every, 3 feet. There's something that, a radar that, picks up at where you are in the prison, all of that. And when I got home, I spoke at the graduation of the guards, and I spoke at the graduation for the those that were being released, and which was just such a beautiful experience for me. I talked about choices, and when I got home, I got a note from my Facebook from that really tough guard at the front, the baddest guard in the baddest prison. And he said, hi, Nicole, my name is, and he put his name, and he said, I wanted to thank you for coming and seeing us and for speaking to us and for what you said, and it's changed so many of our lives. And I was too afraid to say hello, so I thought I would send you a Facebook note.
Aww.
And I thought the baddest guard in the baddest prison in the nation was afraid to say hello
to me. Yeah.
It's so funny how people are afraid to speak, what you do, what they're thinking.
They're afraid to say anything. They're afraid to, all this emotion inside, all this gratitude, all this shift, all this hope, all this vision, and they can't even come up with love.
No. And it's so unfortunate because, you know, if they do not, then their unique expression, you know, one of the things that's always stuck with me is someone told me the best ideas are in the graveyard. And that hurts me to think that the purpose and the vision and the light in people end up in a graveyard as opposed to expressed in this world. And we just can't keep allowing that to happen. We just cannot keep allowing it to happen. We have to continue to work on ourselves. And when we do that, it automatically inspires other people. Because when I perform, I'm thinking about my own experience, right? But the further I go into my own experience, the more it invites someone else to go into theirs. And so what people actually are watching is they're witnessing me, what I call it, ministering to yourself. You know, I don't have to think, what is Nicole going through? I just have to let Nicole see me dealing with me, and then that's going to make Nicole want to go inside and deal with her, you know? And that's it. That's really it. I don't have to force Nicole. I don't have to trick Nicole. I just have to show her. And that's how it is for everybody, you know? And I think that we sometimes get caught up in the, I have to help or show, or like, you just have to, your light automatically liberates other people. It really does. And so I learned, it took me so long, because on the poetry scene, it was really male-dominated. And so the men performed very differently than women. I'm sure you saw some men at my poet. And the men perform, and a lot of their energy goes outward, right? It goes outward. It's all over the place. I mean, it's hitting you, and it's entertaining you, and it's crazy. The women, the best women poets, bring you inward. And I had to learn how to do that. And I started doing it by saying, if I tap into this emotion in me, then it will inspire everybody in this audience to tap into that emotion in themselves. And I guarantee you, by the end of a poem like Butterflies, that person is already thinking about their life. They don't even remember that I'm up there very much. They're in their own experience by that point, you know. And I think that's what it's about, because there's so many people who have things to say, stories to tell, I love yous to give away, and they just will not, because they're afraid of somebody not accepting it. They're afraid of being rejected, of not connecting. And everybody wants to be connected to something, or else we're dead.
Absolutely. You know, and when you think about even just sex, the man goes out, you know, the man goes forward, and the woman takes something in, you know, and so it's the same way that, you know, that the energy comes in, that we consider, you know, energy, love, light, all of that, and then from that we can manifest life, you know, we're able to birth children and create children from something that, you know, is brought in, and so I think that it's just, it's so spectacular that's what you do and how you share and how you teach, and I know that you're just the most incredible therapist, and that people are so gifted to work with you, because the love that you exude and that you share and your emotions and your feelings and your thoughts and the way that you're able to touch people in such a profound and deep level, you know, so I know that on this show that we're talking about, you know, the happiest time when we're getting married, and it's wonderful and it's exciting, and it is. And in order to have the life that happily ever after, and the life that you dreamed, that, you know, one, you might want to think about before you get married.
Yes.
Coming to you and saying, okay, so there are going to be surprises in life. You know, and there are going to be things when the kid falls out of a tree and he breaks his arm or whatever, or when, you know, somebody in our family gets sick or something comes up, you know, we lose money in the market or whatever that is, and how are we going to deal together as a couple situations that come up, or as a family with situations that come up, or when people are married or you're marrying somebody with children and they have, you know,
their own drama with their exes or their own past mm-hmm. families or whatever that is. And before you let things eat at you and before you go into rage, that somebody seek you out for family therapy and figure out
yeah.
what's the best way to do
a plan. A plan.
Yeah.
Let's deal with our stuff. Let's figure out what our stuff is, how it could potentially affect this. And let's figure out how to operate in truth. Let's figure out how to operate in truth. That single thing can save so much time and energy, is just telling each other the truth, even if it hurts. It can save so much time and energy. And I do hope people do that, because I think we tend to, when you're in a relationship, you're in a bubble. And that bubble can become very idealistic, and it can become very, not, I don't want to use the word distorted, but it's skewed towards what you want it to be. And every now and then something pops the bubble, or your head pokes out the bubble, and you look around and you're like, wait a minute, this isn't where I thought this was going to be. But it's because you were in that idealistic bubble. And so part of going to a third party is to bring you back to reality, to give you to a safe sort of transition from the bubble, so that you can make sure that you can exist both in and out of that bubble. Because that's the reality. When the world comes and life comes and things happen, that bubble is going to either burst or expand or take that on and different things. It doesn't stay the same. It will not stay the same. That is the only guarantee you have.
That's such a great image of being in a bubble. Now I'm going to just be kind of floating around my hotel room here at the Bonaventure West.
It is like a bubble. You really think about it. I mean, that's how we keep it, because we don't want to lose the bubble, kind of, you know. So we don't want to know the truth. We don't want to hear reality. And until the bubble gets to be problematic, and then we all are trying to run for the exit.
That's so funny. And then I wanted to ask you, one of the things that we've made a custom on this show is that we always ask our guests for definitions of words. Deirdre Haidt, who you saw speak the other day, talked about what is marriage and what is a vow, and we've talked about what is harmony and what is commitment and a contract. And so what would you say love is?
I think love is acceptance and truth. I think that being who you are and accepting that about yourself and accepting that about the other person. I think when you can do that, you are in love. And I think you feel safe, because love does feel safe. And I really think love and acceptance are very connected.
That's so fantastic. It really is. I love collecting definitions, you know, and
yeah, that's
with your
awesome.
Permission,
you
I would
know,
love
I
to put it up on the website, your definition. So
I would have all those. That's a great idea, Nicole. I would have that, like, plastered on my wall in my house, like different definitions people gave me. I do that. I have a whole list of, I got to make note cards from the conference, from the WIN conference. I got all these quotes and these things, and I put them on postcards, and I put them on a wall in my house. I have a whole wall, and I leave it up for the whole year. And I collect them all year. And at the end of the year, I put all the postcards in the envelope, and I say, well, this is 2013.
Oh, that's fantastic. That, what a great idea that is.
Yeah, I love it. And I go back through the years, and I look at the lessons learned, and I write about it, or I make a workshop about it, and I use it to help.
That's wonderful. Okay, so my word from yesterday, do you remember what my big word was?
You said, well, now, reach.
Reach.
Your
there
word?
You
yeah, your word was reach. I remember. I was paying attention. Reach. I thought that was so cool. I thought that was really, really cool. I mean, because it's all about connecting.
Yes. Absolutely. And I love doing that. And I love reaching people.
Oh, I can
you know, whether it be their heart. That's why, you know, I love doing this show. Is that I can reach people with, you know, with such
incredible tools and techniques and keys and skills and doorways and open windows and portals to their future, to the life that they mm-hmm. dreamt of, that truly that life that they knew they were always meant to live. And then I can have somebody extraordinary like you come on and share your gifts and your talent and your magic. And I know in my heart of hearts, if somebody is looking to, you know, family preservation, that's something I'm going
to
write down. I love
that.
Yeah,
you have to. Isn't that
family
great?
Preservation.
It says everything. It says everything. It says the intention.
That they should absolutely be finding you, and beyond family preservation and family therapy, they should absolutely catch one of your performances and buy your books, because you are so talented, Thea.
Oh, thank you. You are such
a talent and an artist. So I just...
You have to let me know when you finish the book. You have to.
Oh, absolutely. I'm going to read it 1,000 times. I mean, truly, I was like, this is fantastic. And I'm just so, so, so pleased, you know, that we crossed paths, and I look forward to knowing you more and more. And I'm just grateful with us today and on the show. And so once more, just please tell everybody, you know, your website and your phone number and how they can find you.
My website is Thea Monnier, TheaMonnye.com. My email is bookthea, like it says, bookthea, T-H-E-A, @gmail.com. My Facebook is just my name, Thea Monnier, so is my Twitter, and I have information about upcoming shows. I'm doing a play called The Mrs. and the Mistress for the Women of Color Conference, which is going to explore how sexual competition amongst women erodes sisterhood. So I'm really excited about it. And, yeah, the book is Murmurs of a Mad Woman. And, Nicole, anything, anytime, you got all my numbers and all the ways to contact me, I am at your disposal.
Oh, thank you. And you know what I would love to do is, I'm just thinking about this, is when is your play, the Mrs. and the Mistress play?
The Mrs. and the Mistress. I mean, that could actually, it could be a really good play for your listeners. It's November 15th at Cal State LA for the Women of Color Conference.
You know, I would love to also invite the Los Angeles Women Firefighters that were honored yesterday, because I think it'll be a very powerful show for them to be able to come and see. And you know, every day, you meet people that are your mentors and your teachers and your heroes. And certainly, I think we all learned so much from those women yesterday that got up there. They are so brave, and they are so courageous, and they are so beautiful, and they are so strong.
They were amazing.
And they make such a difference in our lives. And so I would love to be able to send out an invitation to them to be able to come to your play.
Definitely.
That would just be wonderful.
I'll send you the link and information. And please, I think we really, you know, just like with the book, this is kind of like my thing. Like, it has to be authentic. It has to be clean. It has to be clear. It has to be raw. And I really wanted to explore this issue from a whole different perspective. It's usually such a judgmental issue, such a black and white issue. People make it, but it's really very nuanced. What leads people to be a part of this dynamic? What leads to affairs? And what are the needs that are being met in this way? And so I think it will surprise a lot of people. I think it will surprise. And I picked two great writers to work on it with me, so I'm so excited.
Well, we look forward to seeing it, and the show is wrapping up, but I just wanted to say thank you so much.
Thank you, Nicole. Yay.
And everybody else, have a wonderful week. This is Nicole Brandon from Los Angeles, from finishing up, wrapping up the WIN Women's Information Network, from Hourglass Bride, wishing you a wonderful week. Thank you again, Thea. Thank you all.
Thank you.